Chapter 5, A Murder on Eliza Street. In the summer of 1881, a William Murray from East Belfast died in hospital as a consequence of alcohol abuse. The countdown to Murray's death began in his home on Eliza Street, where he lived with his wife Jane, their son and their daughter. Murray also worked in East Belfast in an area called Ballymacarrot at a plant, McLeish's, which made vitriol. William Murray enjoyed a flutter on the horses, which he proved one afternoon in July when he had the day off work. East Belfast's population was predominantly Protestant, and so many businesses in that quarter of the city gave extended holidays in the middle of July to allow for their workers to attend the annual celebrations for the anniversary of King William III's arrival in the north of Ireland in the 1690s. The aspiring king had arrived with an army that won several subsequent major military victories that were regarded by many Irish Protestants as a significant part of their heritage. King William's landing and the anniversary of his major triumphs, mainly the relief of Derry and the battles of Aucrim and the Boyne, were typically commemorated with marches and bonfires. William Murray took his horse and cart out of Belfast to horse races being held at an area called the Maze. After the races ended, two of Murray's neighbours headed back to East Belfast, where they saw William's wife Jane and gave her a heads up at the last sighting of her husband. He was pretty deep in his cups. William Murray's drinking wasn't a secret, and it was a problem, which was why the two lads warned Jane. Back at the pub that he'd stopped at en route from the races, Murray started chatting with a punter called Daniel Ward. They started drinking together, sinking pints, discussing the day's races and running out of money. Daniel Ward called it quits, but Murray didn't feel like doing the same. So he hauled himself back up into his cart and made for his home on Eliza Street, where he ordered his wife to give him her day's wages so he could go back to the pub. Like many working class families in the Victorian era, the Murrays could not feasibly survive as a single income household. And so Jane Murray ran the local animal feed store, where she did quite well. William wanted that day's takings to take with him to the pub. It came out later that William Murray had often beaten his wife in the past. In the euphemistic turn of phrase in that part of the city, he wasn't good to her. A saying, the meaning of which everybody in East Belfast understood when they heard it. So rather than protest when William demanded her money to take himself to the pub, Jane went and immediately got him the 7 shillings she had made that day in her shop. Convinced that Jane must have made more than that and that she was holding out on him, William began screaming at her to give him the rest of the money. He refused to believe his wife's insistence that she was telling the truth, and he struck her, just as their teenage son, William Murray Jr., ran into the room, hearing his mother's screams. Younger William told his father to leave Jane alone and to believe her 7 shillings was the profit made by the animal feed store that day. Enraged by his son's defiance, Murray Sr. smacked him as a terrified Jane ran out of the house at her son's urging. Jane's daughter went after her mother, while Murray Sr. continued his argument with his son that moved into the kitchen. The Murray ladies outside on Eliza Street were joined by one of their neighbours, Mrs. O'Neill, who came out of her house when she saw that Jane Murray was bleeding. From outside, the three women could hear the father and son's row continuing in the house. Accounts differ as to what happened next, but Murray Sr. claimed his son lifted up a broom and smacked him with it, causing him to fall. His son insisted that his father had been so drunk that he'd fallen over and hit his head off the kitchen's metal fender. Murray Sr. was screaming in rage and pain for somebody to help. But his wife, paralysed with fear on the street outside, couldn't bring herself to go back inside the house. Murray Jr. was in shock himself at what had happened to his father, and it wasn't until his sister worked up the courage to go back inside that she saw their father bleeding on the kitchen floor, his voice growing less wrathful, quieter, more fearful. The family, with Mrs. O'Neill's help, decided to contact a doctor who arranged for William Murray to be brought from home to the local hospital. An examination there established that Murray had a severe head wound and also a previously undiagnosed knee injury. Police arrived at the hospital from the Royal Irish Constabulary, Ireland's police force, from 1822 until it was disbanded by division in 1922 to be split into the Royal Ulster Constabulary for the north and an Garda Síochána for the south. Ill but vengeful, Murray told the officers that he was in hospital because his son had struck him violently with a broom. This was corroborated, potentially reluctantly, by a doctor who examined Mr. Murray and concluded that the wounds on his head could not have been caused by him falling and hitting his head on a fender. They were caused by blunt force trauma, likely, though not definitely, by something like a heavily swung kitchen broom. A day later, Murray Sr. asked the police to come back to the hospital, where he retracted his statement. He explained he'd been very drunk and that he couldn't remember whether he'd fallen or been hit by his son. The day after that, William Murray died in hospital and the police arrested his teenage son for his murder. As far as they were concerned, the late Mr. Murray had been trying to protect his son with that deathbed retraction. Whether or not Murray Sr. could remember what had happened, the police had the doctor's testimony that it was not credible that Murray's head wound had been caused by a fall. He had been hit with something. And whatever that something had been, a broom, the item specified in Mr. Murray's first statement, was certainly a credible possibility. The reason why I suspect the medical examiner was only imparting this information reluctantly was because he tried to add in the caveat that he couldn't be absolutely certain that the head wound had killed Murray, as he may have been ultimately killed by the infection in his knee. At her son's trial, Jane Murray testified about the abuse she had suffered from her husband, and specifically the violent drunken attack of that fateful day. After being sworn in under the Bible, her daughter confirmed that yes, her father had told her that he'd been hit by her brother, but she hadn't personally seen William Jr. do it. William Jr., for his part, continued to deny that he'd struck his father, even in self-defence. The police too may have started to feel reluctance at prosecuting the case against the teenager as more and more evidence came to light in the courtroom about what an appalling husband and father the late Mr. Murray had been. Although many in the police clearly believed that younger William was committing perjury because they felt all the evidence pointed to him having struck his father with the broom that then sent the older William hurtling to the floor, the consensus seemed to be that the poor young man had swung the broom in panicked self-defence, and why should somebody else suffer in a family that had already suffered so much? So the police had the coroner tell the jury that the Royal Irish Constabulary would be content with an open verdict because the facts were unclear. Nobody could say for certain what had caused William Murray's death. Was it his knee? Was it a fall? Was it an attack? Nobody knew, nor, the coroner led the jury, were they ever likely to know? The jury apparently didn't need much persuading either. An open verdict was quickly returned, allowing the young William to leave as a free man with his mother and sister to return to their much quieter, safer home on Eliza Street. Chapter 6. From Slobland to Snobland, a day in the life of a Malone Road servant. 275 years after it had been legally recognised as a town by King James I, his six times great-granddaughter Queen Victoria granted Belfast the status of a city. As the town had grown with the economy, the centre of Belfast ceased to be where its wealthiest citizens lived. They began to migrate from the hubbub of Donegal Square and Donegal Place, selling their former homes to commercial developers as they headed towards the emerging suburbs. Some of the older money families left Belfast entirely to make for Cultraw, Helens Bay and Hollywood, the loch-facing villages in the north of County Down. Back in Belfast proper, huge Victorian mansions were constructed in the north and east quarters. It was, however, the south section of Belfast that quickly became the one most synonymous with wealth. The area of the city leading towards a southern district called Malone was venue of a property boom in Belfast as the 1880s gave way to the 1890s. The property boom did happen elsewhere in Belfast. The Grand Opera House was built to celebrate the granting of city status in the 1880s. Also, Belfast was emerging as a much more confident city. Shortly after receiving city status, it became the most heavily populated city in Belfast. It outstripped Dublin in terms of population, and it also became the one with the highest living standards, although that's a little bit later. The gentry and the aristocracy began to sell their homes in the Malone area as those like Lord Derrymore quietly withdrew to leave and yield Belfast to her plutocratic capitalist future. The Wilson family made their fortune in this post-city status property boom. Their neighbours in Malone included a who's who of the plutocracy, the Barber family, linen and textiles, the Coreys, timber money, McDonald's, generation upon generation of lawyers, Stevenson's, glue, not glamorous but it pays the bills, or the Johnson's tea. The Malone Road began on an incline, a small hill that, if you're familiar with Belfast today, is the incline just outside Botanic Gardens, on which sits the Ulster Museum, Maggie Mays, and Methodist College. The rest of Belfast was built, or most of Belfast, sorry, was built on an area of slob or flat land. In fact, part of East Belfast, Ballyhackamore, comes from the Irish for town on the flat land or town on the slob land. Anyway, as you started walking up the small hill to Malone, the joke in the 1880s was that you were leaving slobland and entering snobland. Malone's accent began to develop into something distinct, with inconsistently hard and soft consonants and vowels more drawled than most other Northern Irish accents. Schools were built in the area, parks designed and created. But it was those new mansions that are the focus of this particular tale, and they could not have run without their staff. Imagine we're in the home of a Malone Road family in one of the mansions, perhaps one near St. John the Evangelist's Church of Ireland, or any of them emerging in Malone Park, which would become the UK's longest private residential community. We'll give them a fictional name. Let's go for Clark. And it's run by the housekeeper, who is always addressed politely as Mrs. Smith, whether she's married or not. Mrs. Smith is second in command. But it's better to think of housekeepers like Mrs. Smith as regent for the monarchy of the mistress of the house. The housekeeper is the voice of her employer, of Mrs. Clark, the lady of the house. The housekeepers keep order in the home. She watches over staff, especially the female employees, and she keeps a close watch on the household's more expensive items, including its linen, to make sure none of the staff are stealing. It's also the housekeeper's job to make sure the staff who live in the servants' quarters at the house have clean bedding for their own rooms too. A large chunk of the housekeeper's day will be spent going about the house, checking on the rooms, the furniture, as well as negotiating and trading with the Belfast tradesmen who deliver food and necessities to the house. A rare exception to the housekeeper's autocracy is the lady's maid, who alone of all the house staff is allowed to bypass the housekeeper to report directly to Mrs. Clark. The lady's maid's appearance is and has to be immaculate. It's part of the job requirement. And so she looks extremely tidy, hair combed, outfit smooth, as she sails upstairs to help her employer dress for the day. There's a long tradition of other staff disliking the lady's maid, whoever she is, because she is so trusted by their employer and spends hours every day talking to her as she helps her dress in the corsets and gowns of late Victorian high society. There is a suspicion that the lady's maid can tattletale on the other servants or influence the lady of the house against them. The lady's maid is also usually better educated, as being able to read and write fluently is also part of the job requirement. She is expected to have a certain kind of accent, or at least to speak in a way considered proper in the 1880s and 1890s. She has to be a good seamstress and trustworthy. If there's anything that needs mending in the lady's wardrobe, it's her maid's job to do so. Unless it's too difficult, in which case, as a last resort, it can be sent out to be fixed or altered. The lady's maid also has to be a skilled hairdresser, as it's her job to clean, comb and style Mrs. Clark's hair for everyday wear and for parties. Back downstairs, the housekeeper is assigning the day's chores to the parlour maids, the chamber maids, the laundry maids, the stillroom maids and the between maids. Depending on their position, some were sent to light fires in the drawing room, the bedrooms or in the master's study. They then had to make sure they stayed stoked across the course of a day, especially if it's cold outside. Bringing up ewers, bowls and towels with hot water for washing in each family member's bedroom or room is required. These have to be changed and replaced 4 times per day, before breakfast, just before lunch, just before dinner, just before bed. Sometimes it's 3 floors from the kitchen to the family bedrooms, and the water and coal has to go up and down regularly. If the house doesn't have full plumbing for a flushing loo, and at this stage quite a few don't, the staff will need to empty the chamber pots too. Beds will have to be made, then the family's bedrooms tidied, swept and dusted. Maids will be scrubbing floors, polishing grates, and when they're done, there's regular need to scrub candlesticks or oil lamps or the family silver. Down in the kitchens, the scullery maids, regarded as the lowest in the servants' hierarchy, are scrubbing pots and pans, washing dishes and helping the cook. Of all the staff in the Malone Mansions in 1890 or thereabouts, the longest day probably belongs to the maids, the housemaids. At about 6 o'clock in the morning, they rise shortly after the sun in summer and long before it in winter. She gets up, washes her face with cold water left out the night before, dresses herself and goes downstairs to make tea and possibly toast, which she would bring to the housekeeper and the lady's maid before they got up and started their day. The chores I've just mentioned kept them going until about 10 o'clock that night, maybe a little earlier in winter, when the families in Malone tended to retire earlier. This may sound exhausting, and it was, but there were serious benefits, at least comparatively, to winning a job in one of the mansions along the Malone Road or in North or East Belfast. Not only was the pay often better, but your duties, tough as they were defined. It was often a lot harder to be employed by those living in smaller homes, by less wealthy families. For in some smaller households in Victorian Belfast, a maid-of-all-work was employed. Their day started just after dawn and went on until after sunset. Days off were rare, though accommodation and food were included. They had to clean, cook, dust, maybe even care for the family's children like a nanny, all on her own or at most with one other colleague. Small wonder that competition to get a job in Malone was stiff among those in domestic service, those whose jobs made these large homes feasible. For without the servants, Victorian Malone would simply have been unable to exist. Chapter 7. The Duke of Abercorn gives a speech. 20,000 men filed into a huge, specially constructed hall in Belfast. They were the delegates chosen by local unionist organisations to represent each of the 9 counties of Ulster. The hall's seating areas were subdivided for each county. The delegates took their seats, all facing towards a stage dominated by an enormous shield proclaiming Ulster Unionist Convention 1892, God Save the Queen. The monarchy's coat of arms were on prominent display too, as was the convention's slogan, One with Britain, heart and soul, one life, one flag, one fleet, one throne. Journalists from Britain and America had arrived to cover the event, with the reporter from The Times noting the orderly conduct of the delegates and the well wishes for the event's success sent by prominent English aristocrats, including Lord Spencer and the future Prime Minister Lord Salisbury. Solidarity unionist organisations had also been set up in Scotland, Wales and England. All around the hall were slogans, some of them in English, some of them in Latin, some of them in Irish. In quietness and confidence shall be our strength. Liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. Quis separabit, who shall separate us? Erin go brach, Ireland forever. It had been half a century since the famine, nearly a century since the Act of Union. In those decades, social and political attitudes towards the Union had changed dramatically. And a new proposal was gaining popularity, not just in Ireland, but also in Britain, where it had found many liberal allies. And this was something called Home Rule. Home Rule is often mistaken to mean full Irish independence, and the phrases are used interchangeably but incorrectly, because that's not what Home Rule was. It was not a republican ideology, and Home Rule got its initial idea for what Ireland's future could be from a very unlikely source, Imperial Austria. The Austrian Empire sprawled across Central Europe with Vienna as its capital city, and Austria occupying a position broadly comparable to England's position within the United Kingdom. This was resented by many of the people in Hungary in much the same way as many Irish people resented English dominance within the Union. Hungarian nationalists found an unexpected ally at the heart of the empire when their emperor Franz Josef married the Bavarian princess Elizabeth, who found that she much preferred the people and culture of Hungary more than she did to life in Austria. Emboldened by the empress's support for their cause and by continuing populist enthusiasm in Hungary, in 1867, Hungarian nationalism won a major victory when the emperor passed into law something called the Ausgleich. The Austrian Empire ceased to exist as it was rebranded the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The two countries henceforth holding parity of esteem, legal and political equality to one another. They would continue to be united by the same monarchy and by the same foreign policy, but for everything else there would be one parliament that met in Vienna and another which met in the Hungarian capital city of Budapest. The Vienna parliament would decide and debate on local laws for Austria and the rest of the empire, while the Budapest parliament would decide on local laws pertaining to the Kingdom of Hungary. Every time there was a new monarch going forward, he or she would be crowned Emperor or Empress of Austria at a coronation ceremony in Vienna, then travel for another coronation in Budapest, at which they would be crowned King or Queen of Hungary. Moderate Irish nationalists were impressed by the success of the Ausgleich, and they proposed their own version of it for Ireland, Home Rule. The monarchy would remain the unifying force between Britain and Ireland, and when Queen Victoria passed away, her son would be crowned Britain's king at Westminster before coming over to Dublin for a separate coronation at which he was crowned King of Ireland. A new parliament representing all the four provinces of Ireland would meet in Dublin to decide on local matters, while foreign policy would continue to be decided upon in Westminster for Ireland and Britain. Unlike the Dublin Parliament of the previous century, all Irish men, still only men, regardless of their religion or their wealth, would have the vote. This proposal for Home Rule was very popular in the southern three provinces of Ireland, although some Republicans felt very strongly that it didn't go far enough. They were very much in the minority in the 1890s, and they might have stayed that way had Home Rule passed. Just as the Empress of Austria had been a great ally to Hungarian nationalism, the Liberal Party in England proved a great friend to Irish Home Rule. Their rivals, the Conservative Party, also known as the Tories, strongly backed the Unionists. In contrast, however, to the rising enthusiasm for Home Rule, Irish Unionism was demographically very weak in southern and western Ireland, where, on a good day, it could count on the support of about 15% of the population, nearly all of whom were members of the upper or upper middle class, as shown by the membership for southern Unionist organisations like the Irish Unionist Alliance or the Irish Patriotic and Loyal Union. In the north, however, in Ulster, support for the Union hovered at around 70%. In a very large part, this unionism was economic in inspiration. Ulster's economy by the 1890s was industrialised, in contrast to the agrarian economies dominant in the rest of Ireland. Northerners feared that they would be outnumbered in a reconvened Dublin Parliament, which would then introduce tariffs and economic policies that favoured agricultural economies over industrial ones, thereby harming Ulster's living standards. This was also undeniably an era of intense patriotism, with widespread belief in the special or unique nature of Britain in world history. And there were many in the north, especially in Belfast, who feared that home rule would mean them losing their civil and legal liberties as British citizens. Others feared that Ireland's answer to the Ausgleich would lead down the line to the empire disintegrating and the UK falling apart. Finally, there was unquestionably an element of sectarian or religious divisions here, not quite as strong as they were to become in later generations. But by the 1890s, it was accurate to a degree that the exception proves the rule, that Protestants were more likely to be unionists, also known as loyalists, while Catholics were more likely to be home rulers, also known as nationalists. The Catholic Church had become an integral part of sustaining and organising rural nationalism, and some prominent earlier nationalist leaders had liaised with the Church to help coordinate major public demonstrations in favour of the cause. Anti-Catholic sectarianism was potent in many parts of the north of Ireland, but even some moderate Irish Protestants worried about the seeming dominance of the Catholic hierarchy within nationalist politics. Along with favouring economic policies for the South, would a new Dublin Parliament also favour a Catholic educational agenda or prioritise Catholicism as a special status or superior religion in Ireland over Protestantism? This particular fear led to Home Rule being mockingly nicknamed Rome Rule. What marked the Belfast Convention of 1892 as especially significant for historians was that it showcases all of those tendencies. It also marked a moment, I would argue, at which we can see unionism pivoting. The Northern Unionists knew in their hearts, even if they weren't quite yet prepared to admit it in their speeches, that if it came to it, unionism could survive with its numbers in the north, but trying to maintain it in the south was becoming impossible to the point of lunatic. The main Home Rule Party, the Irish Parliamentary Party, with their alliance with the Liberals, had already proved themselves politically effective and popular with southern voters. Unionists in the north began to ask themselves, discreetly at this stage, was the best answer one day going to be to split Ireland into a north that stayed in the Union and a south that had its own Home Rule Parliament? Both sides used mass rallies to advertise their public support, hence the 20,000 chosen delegates flocking to Belfast. The convention of 92 was such a big event that a special commemorative journal reporting all of the major speeches and attendees was being printed so that unionists across Ireland could read about it. In preparation for this podcast, I managed to get a copy of this journal, a commemorative journal, and I'd like to thank the staff at the Linenhall Library for helping me access it, because I wanted to get a full transcript or a transcript of a speech that is going to be read for us by Paul Storrs in a minute. But as always, when you get a source in your hand, there will be a hidden gem. And what a series of hidden gems the journals had. Because of how many people were expected to buy and read this journal, the best of Belfast stores were falling over themselves to buy advertising space in the back of it. I cannot tell you how interesting and how fun I found reading those Victorian advertisements. Why not shop at Alex Dixon and Son Florists to Her Majesty the Queen and to His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, situated on Belfast's Royal Avenue? If you don't feel like flower arranging like a queen, why not rehydrate like a royal by popping over to Cantrell and Cochrane's, the Dublin company with Belfast stores, who provide dining water to the household of their Royal Highnesses the Prince and Princess of Wales. If you need to freshen up your wardrobe, Victorian chaps, we can recommend the shirt makers Hugh McElraths, located on Donegal Street, who took out an advertisement offering their services for old shirts to be refronted or recuffed, along with making good-fitting shirts made to measure or pattern, a perfect fit guaranteed with gents' cuffs and collars, all linen, gloves, white and coloured, night shirts, pyjama sleeping suits, lawn tennis shirts, rugs, lamb's wool shirts. There's also Carmichael's Hat Factory, which you'll be pleased to hear, is now accepting postal orders to supply the public direct with felt hats, hard or soft, all styles and colours, the very best hat that is possible to make at the hitherto unheard of price of 4 shillings and 6 pence. Gentlemen not requiring a new hat can send their old hat to be remade here. The result will be both surprising and gratifying. No fast fashion here. Should you be hoping to spruce up your home rather than your outfit, make sure to remember that Harper & Co., the furniture and curtain shop, are at their temporary premises of No. 8 Wellington Place until the refurbishments at the store at Donegal Street are complete. Now, of course, what Belfast advertisement for the well-to-do and the hoping to do well would be complete without the city's most prestigious department store located in the very centre of the city, Robinson and Cleaver, where Malone and Monarchy meet. That's not a slogan, but I came up with it and I think it should have been. Robinson and Cleaver are the department store of choice by special appointment to Her Majesty Queen Victoria, to Her Imperial Majesty the German Dowager Empress, and to His Highness the Maharaja of Kush Bihar. If you're hungry, consider James Inglis & Co., who've opened a new bread factory on Eliza Street, which, if they do say so themselves, is admittedly the best bread in Belfast. And for those who want politically appropriate cutlery at their dinner tables, why not head on over to Thomas McClelland's store at No. 8 Castle Place, Belfast, to buy their latest piece of dinnerware, the Union Table Knife. Why the name, you ask? Because Thomas McClelland's manufacturer makes a knife so strong that you, the customer, won't be bothered with it falling apart in your hand. And I'm quite serious, ladies and gentlemen. The advertising slogan for the new dinner knife reads, "The Union Table Knife, no separation." But back to the serious business at hand. Rising to the podium to address the delegates was His Grace the Duke of Abercorn. He had fathered 9 children and buried 4. He was a privy councillor, a confidant to the Prince of Wales, one of the prominent aristocratic leaders of the Unionist cause, and the largest landowner in the north, owning just over 76,000 acres in Ulster. Ulster towns like Newton Hamilton were named after the Hamilton dynasty, of which the Duke was head. The Duke of Abercorn was a Unionist to his core, but he knew that the aristocracy now had to share the platform, as Northern Unionism was increasingly vigorous thanks to its middle and working class leaders and supporters. Even in this bastion of conservatism, populism was now a vital part of politics. It's also worth noting that accents of aristocracy had changed. An accent called received pronunciation, or RP, had developed. It's often mistakenly called an English accent. In fact, it was a sociolect, which all aristocrats were taught at their boarding schools or by their governesses. So an Irish duke, a Scottish marquis, a Welsh earl, an English viscount, they would all have had roughly the same accent by 1892. And so Paul Storrs, the actor playing the Duke, uses RP in this extract from the Duke's speech to the convention of 1892.
Men of Ulster, can anyone within this pavilion, who does not possess a heart of stone, be unaffected by the magnificent sight that presents itself? A sight unique in the history of political meetings in this country. It is a grand demonstration, vast in its extent, solemn in its nature. And it is all the more important for the fact that you are not only here in such great numbers yourselves, but as delegates you represent hundreds of thousands of others living in Ulster. It is needless for me to express how deeply honoured I feel at being permitted to preside here today. For it is not often that a man has the privilege of presiding over 20,000 of his fellow countrymen. Indeed, everyone present in this hall must experience feelings of emotion and pride from the consciousness that the motive that has brought us here today is actuated by love of our country, of our families, of our homes, and of our religion, and above all, by the determination to live as hitherto we have done in this country, as an integral portion of Her Majesty's subjects. Now, this demonstration is an indignant protest against the policy pursued towards us. We are on the eve, men of Ulster, of a great political crisis in our history. A great danger threatens us and is hanging over our heads. The loss of civil and religious liberty threatens us if the policy of our opponents is carried into effect. Our first care must be to prevent the British electorate from any longer being misled in regards to the loyal men of Ulster, Protestant and Catholic, who are being misrepresented by statements put forward by politicians eager for power and blind to every other consideration, even the future prosperity of this great kingdom. We are determined to show our English and Scotch friends that the name of Ulster is not a sham, but a reality. That the people who have inhabited it for centuries are determined to live under the same laws, to enjoy the same liberties and privileges as the rest of the inhabitants of the British Isles, and not to be subject to different treatment at the hands of a hostile majority. Our opponents, no doubt, will say, and in fact, the nationalist press have already been endeavouring to spread the claim, that this event is an Orange Order demonstration. It is not so. The object of its organization is to work against a policy of home rule that must sap the foundations of society and bring chaos and destruction where formerly peace and prosperity reigned. Is the intelligence, the skill, the hard-wrought labor of Ulster to be utterly ignored for the furthering of a wild and impossible theory? Our towns are alive with many industries. Our ports and vessels laden with manufacturers to every land. Our shipbuilders are adding yearly to the commercial navies of the world. These are things that can only be achieved by the strong and the self-reliant. Such are the men who proclaim today that their prosperity and liberties must not be jeopardized by the rash experiments of party politicians. A critical period is before us. So, above all, we must have reliance in ourselves. There are many subjects on which the men in this hall differ. I see standing before me stubborn Tory and sturdy Radical, yet standing side by side to save the Union. On this one burning, vital question, we are united. You are fighting for home, for liberty, for everything that makes life dear to you, that makes life worth having. You are indebted for the rights that you now enjoy to the determination of your ancestors. We are resolved to hand them down unweakened and undiminished to our sons. Men of the North, once more I say, we will not have home rule.
As one of the largest British flags ever made unfurled over the convention centre, the sounds of the national anthem began to ring from 20,000 throats. Although the Duke of Abercorn had tried to dance round it as much as he could in his speech, it's no wonder that Southern Unionists saw the Belfast Unionist Convention of 1892 as a betrayal. For they realised that the Unionist men and women of the North were committed, as they put it, heart and soul, to remaining fully citizens of the United Kingdom with or without the Southern Irish counties, with Belfast as the de facto leader. Chapter 8. The Sisterhood of Clonard. It had been 2 years since the interestingly named Roman Catholic Bishop of Down and Connor, the Most Reverend Dr. Henry Henry. That's right, Henry Henry. The name's Henry, Henry Henry. The thing that I don't understand is that there has to have been a christening ceremony for this. Like, and what did they say to the priest? Listen, Father, tell you what it is. We love our surname so much that we thought double the pleasure, double the fun. We'll call him Henry Henry. And the priest didn't think to say, there are literally hundreds, thousands of saints' names that I can give you that are not the same as your surname. Take a pick. No? Okay, I baptize thee Henry Henry. So Henry Henry goes on to become Bishop of Down and Connor. And gives permission for the Redemptorist Order to open a branch in the western neighbourhoods of Belfast. The monks, properly known as the Order of the Most Holy Redeemer, bought Clonard House, the former home of a local mill owner, and they converted its reception room into a chapel where local people could come to hear Mass. The rest of the house became a base and home for the Redemptorists. The Redemptorists' arrival in West Belfast could not have come a moment too soon for Bishop Henry. The Catholic population in the west of the city was booming to the extent that the diocese was struggling to provide the number of masses, baptisms, confessions, first communions, last rites and funerals now needed by the people of West Belfast. Moreover, Bishop Henry was distracted in his feud with the Home Rule Irish Parliamentary Party when its former leader, Charles Stuart Parnell, had earned the ire of the local Catholic hierarchy for his adultery, his Protestantism, and then for his divorce. And relations between the IPP and the bishop had not improved even after Parnell's death in 1891. With the diocese struggling in the face of the sheer number of people it needed to administer to, and Bishop Henry often focusing his attention on increasing his influence over nationalist politics, the Redemptorist monks were a great help and a popular one. Clonard House officially had room for 740 people to hear Mass, 800 at a push, but it was regularly packed with 1,400 congregants. One of the regular congregants at Clonard House was Bridget Quinn, who worked as a maid over on Malone Avenue. She was at Mass at Clonard House on the 20th of June 1897 for a spiritually significant occasion. The blossoming community at Clonard were going to inaugurate a new altar, this one dedicated to veneration of the Blessed Virgin Mary in her guise as Our Lady of Perpetual Help, also known as Our Lady of Perpetual Succour. It was a momentous moment for the observant Catholic community in West Belfast because Clonard's success had attracted the approving attention of His Holiness Pope Pius IX, who had granted permission for a special icon of Our Lady of Perpetual Help to be brought from Rome to Belfast to mark the first Mass at the new altar. Word of the icon's arrival had spread through the parish and been discussed for weeks, leading to a surge in Clonard's already above capacity congregation. However, by the morning of the Mass, the Redemptorists were in a panic. The icon of Our Lady had left Rome on time after a special ceremony of blessing of the Church of San Alfonso. But there had been delays as it crossed Europe, and it was not going to make it to Belfast in time for the service. A celebrated Redemptorist preacher, Father Francis Hall, had come over to Belfast from England to preach that day's homily. Clonard House was going to be filled so above and beyond capacity that people were expected to spill out into the streets to see it, but the icon was not there. Fortunately, two wealthy Catholic ladies, the Kelly sisters, were in Belfast for the ceremony. The Kelly sisters were keen and generous benefactors of the Redemptorist Order, as indicated by the fact that the Kellys had travelled just over 200 miles, specially to Belfast, from their home in Limerick. They had also pledged to finance most of the cost for constructing Clonard's new high altar. On the chance that the icon would not make it from Rome in time, the Kelly ladies had sensibly and sensitively brought with them another holy icon of Our Lady of Perpetual Help, one which had also been blessed in Rome. So the service went ahead on the 20th of June, the feast of Our Lady of Perpetual Help, at which Father Hall announced to the parishioners that Clonard would become the central point for a new Catholic social organisation, which, like the onward icon, was linked to the Church of San Alfonso in Rome. 6 years earlier, with the blessing of Pope Pius IX and of the Vicar General of Rome, Cardinal Constantino Patrizzi, San Alfonso had been the foundational spot for the confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help and St. Alphonsus. A confraternity, a voluntary association of Catholic lay people, i.e. people who weren't members of the clergy, would meet together for religious and social organisations, and they promoted brotherhood and acts of charity within the community. It would now be based out of Clonard, tied to the Mother Confraternity in Rome. Bishop Henry signed the requisite paperwork 1 month later. On the first day of the men's chapter of the Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help in St. Alphonsus, 60 local Catholic men signed up as members. About the same number of boys joined the next day when the boys' confraternity opened in Belfast. But it was to the women of West Belfast that the Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help and St. Alphonsus made its biggest impact. For when the books for the women's chapter opened at Clonard on the 5th of September 1897, 467 local women queued to sign up. The very first in line was Mary Hodgson, another Limerick native, though a far less affluent one than the Kelly sisters. Mary was particularly emotional that day. Mary Hodgson, I should say, was particularly emotional that day. 20 years earlier, she'd moved to Belfast from Limerick for work. She lived about a 5 minute walk from Clonard at Springfield Terrace. And having grown up with a Redemptorist church nearby her in her home city of Limerick, she'd spent 20 years praying that the order would open a church in Belfast. Bridget Quinn, with a day off from her work in Malone, was also there to sign up. Like Mary Hodgson, Bridget had migrated to Belfast for economic reasons, in her case from the southern town of Dundalk. In the queue to sign up to the confraternity, Bridget could spot some of her Belfast neighbours. Every single woman in the Flanagan family who lived on Lower Clonard Street was there, as were all the ladies in the Hayes family who lived over on Odessa Street. They could also hear unusual accents. A whole group of colleagues who were domestic workers in the Ulster Hotel up in Derry had travelled hours on the train to sign up together. There was a Catholic lady down from Ballycastle, a long enough train journey then from the north coast, and one lady from the then almost exclusively Protestant seaside town of Bangor. The Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help and St. Alphonsus became a focal point for these women to express both their faith and a sense of community, of sisterhood. Many of the members of the confraternity worked in the Belfast linen mills, which the diocese then tactfully worked around by making sure to timetable confraternity events on days when the mills were closed. The women started work in the mills at 6 a.m. and broke for their breakfast at 8. They asked, could Mass be moved in the mornings from its scheduled time of 8 to 5 past 8 so that they could make it? Many of the women would stay with the confraternity for decades. There is a photograph from 1957 of 19 of the original signees attending the confraternity's Diamond Jubilee celebrations at Clonard. The parades for the Silver Jubilee in the 1920s and the Diamond in the 1950s were huge, as were attendance numbers for the outdoor masses on both occasions. On the first Easter since the confraternity arrived in Belfast, the Easter of 1898, the diocese and the Redemptorists offered something unusual, or perhaps better to describe it as atypical to the way Catholic confraternities at the time generally functioned. The parish announced that they were organising an Easter retreat when the mills were closed for Easter weekend, but that this retreat was only for female members of the confraternity. The West Belfast chapter's decision to create more and more gender-specific retreats for the women's chapter puzzled the Redemptorist priest and historian Father Peter Burns when he wrote his history, The Clonard Women, in 2019. To quote Father Burns in that book, "There is nothing else in the Chronicle to explain why an inclusive pious association was rather suddenly restricted to women, and given the same outward form as the men's confraternity, with regular meetings organised in sections and with its own spiritual director. Why did the Redemptorists suddenly decide that the women of Clonard deserved or were in need of this?" Burns suggests that this likely was part of the Catholic Church's attempts to tackle an epidemic of alcoholism in West Belfast. Indeed, from the clergy's perspective, the problem was facing the whole city. A Protestant pastor in the East described late Victorian Belfast as a city that is soaked in liquor. Both Catholic and Protestant clergy noted with alarm that Belfast in 1897 had one pub for every 328 residents, and that this ratio was far higher in its working class neighbourhoods. As illustrated earlier in the story we heard about the tragedy of Jane Murray on Eliza Street, alcoholism as ever was intimately tied to domestic abuse and violence. Father Burns suggests in The Clonard Women that this sudden organisational pivot by the Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help in St Alphonsus was to offer help to its female members to deal either with their own potential alcohol problems, if they had any, but also to escape into safe female-only spaces if alcohol dependency in their husbands or fathers left them feeling unsafe at home. There had already been several Catholic and Protestant organisations founded to tackle the societal impact of alcoholism in Victorian Ireland. The Jesuit Order had founded the pioneer Total Abstinence Order of the Sacred Heart in 1857, and in 1898 the Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help liaised again with a Catholic order based in Rome. They introduced the Saturday League to Belfast, which encouraged general avoidance of alcohol, but specifically incorporated a vow for its members not to take any alcohol between lunch on Saturday and lunch on Sunday, with Saturday evenings and nights being proven as the most dangerous time for the temptation to drink. The Saturday League, like the Confraternity itself, had its headquarters in Rome, in this case at the Redemptorist Church of Santa Maria in Monterone. The women in the Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help formed a special bond that included looking out for all their neighbours, especially if any of them were struggling with bills. A discreetly dropped off meal could help, and there were women known to help with emergency childbirths or with laying out the dead for the Irish custom of a wake. They formed sub-organisations of their own, like the Pious Union of the Most Holy Redeemer, whose members organised funds to help neighbours in need and to contribute towards the hoped-for one-day rebuilding of Clonard House into a monastery and church big enough to adequately service the Catholic community of West Belfast. These organisations were not without their critics. Some people were thoroughly unimpressed by the fact that the Ladies' Pious Union of the Most Holy Redeemer was fundraising, with weekly donations of either sixpence or threepence from its members. These critics did not criticise the women themselves, but the fact that this fundraising was necessary in the first place. In a community that was largely working class, why on earth were its people being made to fundraise for a new church building for an organisation like the Roman Catholic Church, which, as sceptics claimed, was astronomically wealthy? As the joke went, it would be like Queen Victoria walking around, crown in hand, asking for donations from her servants to contribute to their accommodation. The Catholic journalist and future Nationalist Party Member of Parliament for West Belfast, Joseph Devlin, was critical of the way the church operated at times, and in particular he felt that Bishop Henry was quite content to let the people of the diocese look after themselves while he remained distracted by capitalising his influence in Nationalist political organisations, newspapers and social clubs. The Confraternity of Our Lady of Perpetual Help, or Perpetual Succour, was to become an integral and beloved organisation in West Belfast for the next century. Generations passed through it, where they formed friendships in faith. It offered refuge, camaraderie, and it mattered very much to its members. Ashley Montgomery reads the testimony of the daughter of a former member.
Mum was still going just before her 80th birthday. Indeed, it was the prayers and faith in our Blessed Lady and all her wonderful friends at Clonard that kept her going. I was always being told that when I was born in 1957, she had a lovely year at Clonard, as it was their Diamond Jubilee. It meant so much to Mum. She used to think I was so lucky to be born in that year to have such blessings from Our Lady. It meant a lot to her. When she went to Mass, she sat in the same seat beside the same friends and ladies, all gathered to gain strength from prayer and our Heavenly Mother's help and support. They had confidence in each other and in Our Lady.
The confraternity passed through many years, coming a long way from the day in 1897 when Mary Hodges and Bridget Quinn had queued to sign their names in its first register near the special icon of the Holy Virgin, blessed in Rome. Chapter 9, our final tale, A Party with Thomas Andrews. 9 years before he acquired historical immortality by drowning on the Titanic, a ship he had helped design, 29-year-old Thomas Andrews Jr. flung open the doors to his apartment on Wellington Place, Belfast, to welcome in friends and family for a party. If anyone very familiar with Belfast city centre is interested, it was number 11, so Andrews rented the house next to what I think is now the Warhammer store. I'm not sure what the building at number 11 is called off the top of my head, but it's basically directly opposite Sticks and Stones. That's where he lived when he was a bachelor in Belfast and where he hosted this party in 1903. His father, Thomas Andrews Sr., chairman of the Belfast and County Down Railway Company, chairman of the Down County Council, and president of the Ulster Liberal Unionist Association, arrived with a beaming handshake and, "Well, my big son, how are you?" Which is how he always greeted him. Tommy Andrews was the second of the Andrews sons, but the big son, because according to a family friend, he was nearly 6 feet high, weighing some 200 pounds, well built, with broad shoulders and great physical development. I had this, when I was talking about this quote from with a friend before I recorded this, I said it's interesting that they describe their friends more kindly than we often in the Victorian era than we describe our romantic partners. On reading this, this chap might have been hiding something of a secret. It's very thorough about Tommy's. This gentleman might have had an unrequited crush. I can't be certain of that. I can tell you that this guy, he goes on to say, he had dark brown hair, sharp, clean-shaven features. You would call him handsome. Brown eyes, a wonderful ringing laugh, an easy way with him, an Irishman's appreciation of humour. He was sunny. Now, I don't know whether this gentleman was gay or in the closet or something. It was just in love, unrequited love, I should say. But I don't know that. I can tell you that from reading this, he definitely was in the ascendancy. Because the next few sentences of this man writing about Thomas Andrews, his name is Sam Bullock, are basically, tell me you're in the ascendancy without telling me you're in the ascendancy. He was sunny. Give him health, plenty of friends, plenty of work, and occasionally some spare hours in which to enjoy a good book and some good music and to go yachting on Strangford Loch. Only a member of the ascendancy could say, you can give him the simple things in life, his health, a good book, good music, and a yacht. So give him health, plenty of friends, plenty of work. I'm going to read that again, all of Sam Bullock's. This is Sam Bullock's description of Thomas Andrews, his social and private life excised from my commentary. According to a family friend, Tommy was nearly 6 feet high, weighing some 200 pounds, well built with broad shoulders and great physical development. He had dark brown hair, sharp, clean-shaven features. You would call him handsome. Brown eyes and a wonderful ringing laugh. An easy way with him. An Irishman's appreciation of humour. He was sunny. Give him health, plenty of friends, plenty of work, and occasionally some spare hours in which to enjoy a good book and some good music and to go yachting on Strangford Loch or picnicking, and he was thoroughly content. And he was also particularly content in the company of his family. His dad arrived at the party with Tommy's mother Eliza and their daughter, another Eliza, though everyone in the family called her Nina. The eldest brother John arrived with his new English wife Jessie, daughter of a Mancunian stockbroker. 26-year-old James, a brilliant lawyer. James was another of Tommy's brothers, trained at Trinity in Dublin. He hoped to follow their uncle into a career as an Irish court High Court judge, I should say, and he helped himself to some of the many, many treats Tommy had laid out for the guests, which were also enthusiastically tucked into by the youngest of the Andrews siblings, 17-year-old William. He was the only one of them still a student at the Royal Belfast Academical Institute, INST, the previously mentioned all-boys school that lay only a few hundred feet from Tommy's apartment. Called Big Willie because of his height, the gangly, thin, pale, still slightly squeaky-voiced, cricket-mad William was fretting that his batting skills weren't up to par to win him a place on the school's first 11. As he wolfed down another pastry, William explained to his brother that he was keen to make sure he played sufficiently well so he could score a win against his school's mortal rivals at Methodist College, or Methody, situated at the top of the Malone Road. Uncles, aunts and cousins arrived at Tommy's party and Tommy started giving piggybacks to the children. And when not doing that, he kept bringing out more and more baked goods and sweets, dainties, as they were known at the time. The windows to the apartment were flung open, inside and out were decorated with row upon row of red, white and blue bunting. From the streets below, the hubbub of the crowd could be heard as they, like the Andrews family, waited to see their new king. Then, officers on horseback clipped and clopped down the streets of Belfast Centre, as the Andrews men and women hung out the apartment windows and waved little British flags on sticks. An open coach trundled into view and the crowd's cheers roared to the deafening. The genial figure of His Majesty King Edward VII was carried into view, bowing and waving to the crowds. Edward VII's love of fine food, cigars and port had already earned him the secret nickname Tum Tum in high society circles. Beside him in the coach, smiling as she acknowledged the crowd's cheers, was Edward's 58-year-old Danish wife, Alexandra. Alexandra of Denmark was, like Elizabeth Boseleyn, Diana Spencer and Catherine Middleton after her, to become a consort-contained conduit of acclaim for the British monarchy. Alexandra had been one of the most popular members of the royal family since she first married the Prince of Wales 40 years earlier. She was so popular that when she injured her knee, socialites had started limping to all the best parties because if Princess Alexandra limped, it must be the height of fashion. That's not a joke, by the way. The Princess Alexandra limp was a thing that was done in the 1870s, I think, or the 1860s. But I have to wonder, what did Alexandra think when she saw all these socialites limping towards her? I hope she didn't think they were making fun of her, but it must have been a pretty bizarre sight. People said you could see them at garden parties and balls limping because they assumed Alexandra was doing it to introduce a new fashionable way to walk. As the little cousins gazed down on the passing royals from Cousin Tommy's shoulders, an uncle asked, "What did you think of the king?" "Cousin Tommy is our king," cheered the piggybackers. Queen Victoria had died 2 years earlier after 63 years on the throne, but a spell of ill health delayed her son's coronation and his intended visits. The new king was at last in Belfast to open a hospital that bore his late mother's name, the Royal Victoria, and the royals were staying at the Londonderry's house at Mount Stuart, where Queen Alexandra was shown some of the original chairs that Lord Castlereagh had brought back from the Congress of Vienna 88 years earlier. She thought it was a hoax, one of those sort of claims that many country houses have. This belonged to Marie Antoinette. No, it didn't. So she thought the chairs were a hoax until somebody helpfully showed the same chairs in a portrait painted at the Congress. In some sense, I would say it was King Edward and Queen Alexandra's visit in 1903 that marked the end of Victorian Belfast, at least for the purposes here. A new Edwardian chapter in the city's history had begun, in which many of the issues of the Victorian era were to intensify in terms of prosperity, politics and prejudice. And maybe in the next season of this podcast, I'd like to return to tell stories of Edwardian Belfast because I've loved researching, telling and sharing this Victorian sprinkling of histories. Had the news criers who announced the Marquess of Londonderry's suicide in 1822 suddenly been brought back to see King Edward VII ride through Belfast in his carriage in 1903, they would not have recognised it. Belfast's population was 17 times greater in 1903 than it had been in 1822. The city was home to 192 linen manufacturers, massive rope works and tobacco factories. Belfast had one of the lowest urban rates of infant mortality anywhere in the British Empire. With 82 state-funded schools, it had the highest rate of literacy for any part of Ireland. Its authorities had implemented provisions for the care of the deaf and the dumb long before most other towns in Ireland. Among the city councillors standing to welcome the King and Queen was the former Lord Mayor of Belfast, Sir Otto Jaffa, an immigrant from Germany turned merchant and philanthropist who had helped build the city's first two synagogues. He was president of the Belfast Hebrew Congregation, which worshipped on Great Victoria Street, around the corner from Tommy Andrews' home. The royals saw Belfast's impressive waterfront customs house, massive banks, and official buildings constructed in imitation of Italian palaces. They passed too the sandstone turrets of Robinson and Cleaver, decked out in monarchist slogans and flags for the day, all of which reflected off the 3,000 square feet of polished mirrors that lined the department store's interiors, connected by white marble staircases decorated with statues of Britannia. Perhaps nothing was more intrinsically linked to the industrialised capitalist prosperity of turn-of-the-century Belfast than its shipyards, specifically Harland and Wolff, where Tommy Andrews worked. A detail-obsessed designer and a workaholic, Andrews had recently completed working on the luxury passenger liner Cedric, a 21,000-tonne ship, then the largest in the world, that carried passengers from Liverpool to New York with a stopover in the southern Irish port of Queenstown. In recognition of his talents, Andrews had also just been admitted as a member into the Royal Institution of Naval Architects. As the party to cheer the King and Queen broke up at No. 11 Wellington Place, Tommy Andrews was talking to relatives as they said goodbye, who told him that a younger cousin had set off to England for a while to study as an engineer, hoping to follow in Tommy's footsteps. They asked if he'd any advice for his cousin, and so Tommy fired off this letter to the young man, read by actor Paul Storrs.
I am sorry I did not get to shake your hand, old chap, before leaving. Just to wish you good luck and a good time. Please accept from me the enclosed small gift to go towards a little pocket money. You are such a sensible boy that I know you require no advice from me. But as an old hand who has come through the mill myself, I would just like to say how important it is for you to endeavour to give your employers full confidence in you, from the start. This can be best gained by 1. Punctuality and close attention to your work at all times. But don't allow your health to suffer through overwork. 2. Always carry out instructions given by those above you, whether you agree with them or not. And try to get instructions in writing if you are not sure of the character of your man. 3. Always treat those above you with respect, no matter whether they are fools or no less than yourself. 4. Never give information unless you are perfectly sure. Better to say that you are not sure and that you will look the matter up. 5. Never be anxious to show how quick you are by being the first out of the shop when the end of day horn blows. It is better, on those occasions, to be a bit slow. Now, this is starting to sound like a sermon by Thomas. But it's only that of a cousin who has high expectations of you and is interested in your welfare. Goodbye and good luck. Thomas.
The Andrews family left Tommy as he prepared to go back to work the next day at Harland and Wolff, from which they'd all been given the day off for the royal visit. A century earlier, Tommy's ancestors had fought for the 1798 rebellion. Now the entire family, non-subscribing Presbyterians, had gathered to clap and cheer their king and queen from an apartment decorated with British bunting. Tommy's rebel Republican ancestor, William Drennan, had apparently been the first to call Ireland by its famous nickname, the Emerald Isle, in one of his poems. Tommy's father, however, was president of a prominent local unionist association, and he had been made a privy councillor by Queen Victoria to celebrate her Diamond Jubilee in 1897. Belfast, politically, economically, demographically, had been transformed utterly by the Victorian century. That's the nature of time. Realising that memories of Belfast the town before it was Belfast the city were vanishing, local historical and archaeological societies tried to interview those few who could still clearly remember what the city had looked like when King George, not Queen Victoria, reigned. Now, regular listeners of this podcast may remember how much I love a good name. I refer you to season one's Sir Marmaduke Constable. So imagine my delight to encounter Belfast clergyman Reverend Narcissus G. Batt. He sounds like one of the fun characters in Harry Potter who you want to spend more time with, and not just because it'll mean reading less time about Ginny Weasley. Reverend Narcissus Batt had been born in the 1820s on the street that is now Royal Avenue, where his family home, one of the best in Belfast, was located. His merchant father had bought the house from the Marquess of Donegal. Narcissus, who was an infant when the news of Lord Londonderry's suicide broke in the town, could remember things like society disapproving of the Earl of Belfast's beard, because although gentlemen's beards were fashionable at the end of the Victorian period, they were considered uncouth at the start. He could also remember how he'd seen carts and cries of "Bring out your dead" during the Belfast cholera epidemic of 1834. Reverend Batt's reminiscences, read by Colm Doran, seem like the best way to end these tales from Victorian Belfast, wrapping them up with his words for the Ulster Journal of Archaeology when he looked back from 1896 to the Belfast of his childhood, to what Belfast had been like when Marianne McCracken was young and protesting against slavery, Lord Castlereagh agonising over his sexuality, William Drennan writing poems about an Emerald Isle.
Donegal Place, now full of shops, was, half a century ago, a quiet street of private homes. Some of them had gardens and trees in the rear, and there was quite a grove of trees at the corner of the square where Robinson and Cleaver now have their establishment. The residents were either merchants of the town or country gentlemen who came to Belfast for society parties in the winter, as fashionable people now go to London for the season. My father, Samuel Hyde Batt, took a week to come from England when he went. And Uncle William, when studying at Trinity College, used to ride to and from Dublin with a groom behind him, carrying his luggage. There was good local society in Belfast, and its people were hospitable. My mother was often taken about the town in her sedan chair to spend the evening at a dinner party at some of our neighbours.
If you enjoyed the dramatised extracts for the eyewitness testimonies from Victoria and Belfast, then please join me in thanking for their time and talent Caelum Carraher for playing Lord Byron, Member of Parliament John Martin and the anti-Castlereagh poets, Emily Rose Edgar for singing The Fields of Athenry, Danny Cunningham who played Dr. Charles Bankhead and the lawyer John Mitchell, Colm Doran, our Reverend Narcissus Batt and the journalist from the Northern Whig, Jake Douglas for bringing to life the second Marquess of Londonderry, he who had been Lord Castlereagh, Marianne Maguire as Marianne McCracken, Ashley Montgomery as Maggie McKinley and Maura McLaughlin, and Paul Storrs, who as an alum of Methody, indeed emeritus head boy of Methody, made the great sacrifice of playing old Instonian Thomas Andrews. And no, when I asked him to participate, I did not inform him of those details. Too late, he said yes, as well as playing the coroner from 1822, the editor of the Belfast Vindicator, and the second Duke of Abercorn. My thanks to them and to you, our listeners, as always. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, comment, all the good things. If you enjoyed this episode, if you didn't, go with God. And don't forget to tune in next week for our episode on the life of the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut. I've been Gareth Russell. Thank you.